I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Action News, Delaware Valley's leading news program with Scott Palmer, Dave Roberts, Lisa Thomas-Laurie, and Mark Howard.
From 1978 until she retired in 2016, Lisa Thomas-Laurie anchored and reported on the news for WPVI-TV in Philadelphia. That's Channel 6. She was a trailblazer, one of the first African-Americans to anchor the news in a major U.S. city. And she was at the top of her game until she began to experience strange pains in her feet and ankles. That was about 15 years ago. Her condition deteriorated when she was misdiagnosed, eventually losing her ability to walk and even talk. She finally got the right diagnosis at the Mayo Clinic, an unusual plasma cell disorder called POEMS. She's had two transplants and struggled with an addiction to pain medication. She's now the author of a book, On Camera and Off, When the News is Good and When It's Not. And Lisa Thomas-Laurie joins us on Radio Times to talk about her broadcasting career and what her health condition has taught her. Lisa Thomas-Laurie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty, and thanks for that wonderful musical introduction.
I saw you perk up when you heard that.
The Action News theme, absolutely.
Let me just give out the phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499. To join our conversation, you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to spend a lot of time, or a fair amount of time, talking about this POEMS syndrome, but I also want to talk about how you got into broadcasting and how you came to Philadelphia. But first of all, how are you feeling? How is your health?
Oh, it's much, much better. The POEMS, which is an acronym we'll talk about in a few minutes, but is in sort of a remission. And I'm feeling better, much more active, getting out and walking a little bit in my neighborhood. And, of course, with the book, you know, being
that helps,
active.
Right?
Yeah, it helps to get out and promote it and talk about it with people. It wasn't something that was planned, but I'm really, really glad I did it.
Well, let's talk about Lisa Howard. That's the name you grew up with, and you grew up in Institute, West Virginia.
Right.
This was in the early 50s.
Yes.
You were the oldest child, family of what?
Four.
Four children.
Mm-hmm. Three younger brothers.
What was Institute, West Virginia like?
Institute, West Virginia. You know, it was a very tight-knit community and a fun place to grow up. I don't think as children we realized that we were growing up in Chemical Valley. You know, it had the largest concentration of chemical plants at that time, I think, in the country, with the carbide plant and many, many others. So there were those problems, but I had a wonderful childhood. You know, I recently returned to my elementary school reunion.
Elementary school reunion?
Yeah,
okay.
Institute Elementary. They asked me to come bring the book, and believe it or not, there was a 43% turnout. The last principal at Institute Elementary came. Her daughter brought her. Her 88-year-old daughter brought her.
So how old was the principal?
103. Made headlines, as you can imagine. But, it was a lot of fun. And I saw people and friends that I've been in touch with, some of them on Facebook, but hadn't seen in 45 years.
You write it was at this school that you fell in love with writing.
Yes, yes.
And you were a good writer. You wrote The Girl in Red Shoes.
Well, you know, it's funny. People, that's the one thing that long ago lost friends tell me they remember. They said, we used to love your plays. Everyone would vie for a lead in the play and wanted to be in the plays. And most often I would cast myself as the lead.
Well, of course.
But I did. And, you know, my father had given me a thesaurus, and he was a major in English and literature. And I think I developed his love for the written word and writing and producing things, if you want to call producing elementary school plays production. But they were, in a sense. And I nurtured that love for writing into my junior high and high school years.
Now, this was before Brown versus the Board of Education. So was this?
It was the same year.
Oh, it was the same year.
My
okay.
birth year, 1954, okay. Brown versus the Board of Education. And there were a few white students in my elementary school, but it was predominantly a black community. So the school was predominantly black.
you did go on to high school and then to college, and you were, I guess you could say back in those days, the weather girl or a weather girl.
The weather girl.
For an NBC affiliate.
Yeah, Marshall University is when I got that job, my second semester of my freshman year. And an upperclassman friend, Bill Dodson, told me, he knew I was looking for a job. My grant had run out, and I needed to make some money. And he said, you would be great for this. His sister, who is preeminent in her field as a broadcast journalist, I should say print journalist.
Oh, there you go.
Also was being considered for it, but she really didn't want to do broadcasting. And so they both convinced me to do it. Adrienne Belafonte, the daughter of the civil rights activist and actor, Harry Belafonte, was the first, but her time as a weather girl was short-lived. So many, many people thought of me as the first black weather girl at the station. But it wasn't like being a meteorologist today.
It was just pointing to maps.
I needed to know the low pressure and the high pressure and all of the states and be able to turn gracefully and point to them and pronounce them correctly. And that was the gist of being a weather girl.
But was that also the thing that got you interested in broadcast?
It did, because on the side, I was following the reporters and learning how to be a reporter. And seeing if that might be something that interested me, and it did very much. My first big story, I wouldn't call it a documentary, but it was a two-part story, was on the wastewater treatment plant in Huntington. And I got big, big, major approval from the news director. I was very proud of that. But
feels good to get that.
Yeah, yeah.
You also worked with a woman, I don't know what happened to her career, named Oprah Winfrey.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? I will never forget. It's like yesterday. I had received a call from the news director, Chris Clark, at WTVF in Nashville, Tennessee, to come interview for an education reporter job. I was in Oklahoma at the time, and there was not a lot going on in Oklahoma. I was dying to leave Oklahoma. So I came in, and I remember that Sunday night before my Monday morning interview, sitting on the edge of the bed in awe of this African-American woman. We weren't African-American then, but she was just phenomenal. I was, I think I was 19.
Wow.
I think I was 19, was fresh out of college. And I imagine she was around the same age, but I couldn't be sure. And I met her the next morning. She was one of the first people I saw. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I had a little time before my interview, and we chatted and found out that we had some things in common, that we were the exact same age. And just a nice conversation. And I stayed overnight with her that night. She invited me to be her guest in her apartment, and I marveled at her. I remembered, I wrote a thank you note after I left and sent to her for having me over, her wonderful hospitality, and when she became syndicated after she beat out Phil Donahue, I was the Oprah reporter. I was just beginning to become the Oprah reporter because I had crossed paths with her, and went up to Harpo Studios. Well, actually, she didn't have Harpo Studios quite yet. Right. But when we first met, when she went through the cities to announce her syndication, she brought out that note I had given her. I said, you are going to do great things. I just know it. And she had kept that, like she does a lot of memorabilia from people.
Well, interestingly, she was actually in competition with you for this job at WPVI in Philadelphia.
Yeah,
you beat her out.
Yeah, yeah. she revealed that at my retirement party, and that became the big news. Excuse me. But we never talked about it after it happened. I knew it happened. I knew she had come, and she knew that I was going for the interview. And when I got it, we really never discussed it. But she went on, of course, to Chicago. She didn't do so well as an anchor, admittedly. She often talked about how she knew that that wasn't her calling, and she wasn't treated very nice by the co-anchor there in Baltimore. But, of course, she went on and did pretty well for herself.
She sure did. Well, you talk about anchoring, but you also talk about the fact that when you came to Philadelphia, people weren't sure, are you black? Are you white? Are you Hispanic?
For about 6 months.
Who is Lisa Thomas Laurie? In fact, you even described someone saying, maybe you should consider doing something with your nose because he thought you were white. And you had to say to him, no, I'm not white.
Right. That sort of racial bewilderment was in my family and experienced most often by my mother. But that incident you speak of about suggesting I get a nose job happened in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh.
And, I did have to – we were doing a modeling shoot, some of the news reporters and anchor women, and he just assumed that I was white. But when I came to Channel 6, my mother came in one day to meet – the news director and the general manager, and she knew immediately, and she told me that evening, she said, there might be a little situation, because I think your general manager is wondering now what your race is.
Oh.
She could
Did
tell
they think
by,
they had hired an African-American?
Well, the way it was explained to me, they thought and wanted to hire a young black woman. And, they thought they had. I remember there was some question about things I had on my resume, clubs that may have been identified with, black individuals versus white. But when my mother showed up with her blonde hair and her blue eyes, and they were wondering, and I'm fairly light-skinned. I had a tan that summer. I came in the winter to start my job, and I was really, much lighter. And, the way it was explained to me, there was a meeting about it. And the assistant news director at the time called me in, and it became pretty obvious that the way they were going to work this out was to show me the article that was going to air in the newspaper, which said, PVI hires black woman to anchor new news, first time. And I have to admit, Marty, I was tempted to respond in a negative way, just for the heck of it. But, of course, I said, I'm delighted. This is wonderful. And I think they were okay. They knew. But, Oprah and I even had a discussion at one time. And I wanted to say it first because it's a sensitive thing, the racism within the black race even today. But we both knew why I was hired. I didn't have the expertise as an anchor woman. I hadn't really anchored a show. I had done cut-ins. I felt that I could, but when that started to happen and the FCC wanted women and minorities to get opportunities, we were double minorities, and she knew, but I said openly to her, I know they want me because I'm light, I'm not too black, and I think she appreciated that. Because you can imagine the slight that was felt.
Absolutely. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Lisa Thomas Laurie. She's got a memoir. It's called On Camera and Off, When the News is Good and When It's Not. Longtime anchor, WPVI Channel 6 here in Philadelphia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Lisa Thomas Laurie. She's got a new book, On Camera and Off, When the News is Good and When It's Not. We've been talking about her growing up in West Virginia, landing a job in Philadelphia, and we do want to spend some time talking about this rare, chronic, potentially deadly syndrome that she has been dealing with for the last 15 years or so, and it's called POEMS. And you can join us at 1-888-477-949. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Just one little thing. Your last name was Howard.
Right.
But your co-host was also someone whose last name was Howard, Mark Howard.
Yes.
So you became, Howard became Thomas?
Yeah. When a gentleman came down and saw me on the morning show or the news in Nashville, he was sort of a talent scout, and took me up to Philadelphia, and they were strongly considering hiring me. They said, one thing, would you have any trouble, changing your name? Because we do have a Mark Howard. We don't want there to be any confusion. So I chose my mother's maiden name, Thomas. And about 6 months later, a young man from Buffalo was going to be hired to do the morning talk show. His name was Dave Thomas.
Oh.
And they told Dave Thomas, you can't be Dave Thomas. We have a Lisa Thomas. So he chose Roberts. I don't know. I think just out of the air. And, of course, his real name is Dave Boreanaz. His son is on a new show, Team Seal now.
Exactly.
With Bones. And funny little story we tell about names.
But you enjoyed anchoring?
I did. I struggled with it a little bit. I had some uneasy times.
And you had to learn to say Moya Mensah, Bala Kinwood, all these strange Philly names.
Yeah, thank God I anchored with Jim O'Brien. He really took me under his wing and just sort of protected me. I realized I made a mistake in the book when I said I was 24, because I was 23 until July. So I was pretty green, and having not anchored, especially a half-hour show, it was great to have him on the at the anchor desk with me. I had written those names and seen those names in print, but for some reason when I went to pronounce them on the air, they just didn't come out right. Concha Hawken and... things that I hadn't been used to in Institute. I had Louise Street and Andrew Boulevard and, Charleston.
You describe it was about 2001 beginning to feel these sort of strange sensations in your feet and your ankles. What did you think was going on?
I really didn't know, Marty, at first. I was in the best shape I'd been in. I had a trainer, and my daily schedule involved taking my boys to school, coming back, working out. My trainer would come, and we would walk the neighborhood, power walk. And then I'd come back and do a little more weightlifting, feeling just great. My girlfriends used to tease me, boy, you have Madonna arms. Today there would be Michelle Obama arms. But I started noticing a weakness in my ankles and a strange sensation in my toes and the bottom of my feet. First, I went and got a spa pedicure, thinking maybe some calluses. Or my husband sent me to a neurologist who gave me cortisone injections between my toes, thinking I had little tiny tumors or ganglions or something. And within another few weeks, I went to another neurologist and had an ENG test, a nerve conduction study test. And that's when they discovered that I indeed had lost about 30% of the strength in my ankles, that my nerves had weakened. Big question was why, and what was this? So that began the great journey.
Yeah, it seemed like that it took a while to figure out that you had this POEMS. Years and years.
Let me tell you, it didn't at first. As I describe in the book, there was one doctor who got it right in a few weeks, and that was my husband's mentor, former chief of neurology at Lankenau Hospital, Dr. Edgar Kenton, just a wonderfully intelligent, bright man. He did a half-day study testing on me. He said, I think you have this rare condition called POEMS syndrome, and I've only had 5 cases in my career. And unfortunately, I'm leaving to do medical research. I'm not going to be at Lincoln. I was going to Atlanta, Morehouse. And he referred me to a neurologist at Johns Hopkins and a hematologist at Lankenau because it was a plasma cell dyscrasia disorder, a blood disorder. Lo and behold, they treated me for a while, maybe a month, going along with his diagnosis, and they both put their heads together and dismissed it and were convinced that I had something called CIDP, which is chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy.
But meanwhile, while all this is going on, you're losing the ability to walk, to talk.
It didn't happen so fast. It happened slowly, but yes.
What?
Yeah, after, I went almost 2 years with the wrong diagnosis, after being handed the correct diagnosis, and, imploring the doctors and my new doctors to revisit this POEMS. My husband was a physician himself. You can imagine how frustrating that was. He thought he was asking all the right questions, and it was always about that underlying blood disorder. But these two doctors assured us that, that we really want to follow this course. We had not enough knowledge but to go along with them. And sure, along the way... it's funny because sometimes the prednisone will mask your feelings. The steroids in general will mask your symptoms and make you feel like maybe I am getting better. They'll give you a sense of strength and The poems were strange itself. Sometimes I'd have the symptoms more severely than others. New symptoms were developing. But I ultimately suffered a paralyzed vocal cord, and then my digestive tract was, I think it's the vagus nerve in the stomach, was affected, where I couldn't digest food properly. And
were you dying?
Well, yeah. Yeah. By the time I got to the Mayo Clinic, and this wonderful doctor who had written the standard of care for poems, Dr. Angela Dispensieri, I was pretty weak. She said, "You've got poems. You've had it all along. It is shutting you down."
And that was within really not moments, but very quickly she figured out this is what you were dealing
with. A week
of
tests.
Right.
She did every day for the week up until Friday when I met her. She did every test you can imagine, EMGs, EKGs, you know, biopsies, bone marrow biopsies, a day of testing for 4 days, and she didn't have a question. She didn't say you might have it, all indications are you have it, you got it, right. And it's shutting you down. I'll never forget those words, because I think I was in denial a little bit, you know. So much of my life had changed. I was wheelchair bound, and my husband was scared to death trying to be strong for me, but it was it was an incredibly difficult time.
I can only imagine. Once you get the diagnosis, then she says, and you're going to need to have a bone marrow transplant in order to address this problem.
Right. But she always gave me hope. She says, you're going to get a lot better, but you need a bone marrow transplant, but you can't have it now. You're too weak. You're not strong enough. She sent me home with a new diet, something to build up my pulmonary system, because it was very, very impaired. And two months later, I came back and had the bone marrow transplant, and almost immediately
you started to feel better.
I started, the symptoms left. You know, the first thing to get better were the last symptoms I had. My voice box came back, you know, the paralysis left in my vocal cord. And my digestion got better, so yeah, I felt a lot better because I wasn't nauseous and throwing up all the time. I could digest my food.
And that's Lisa Thomas-Laurie. We're talking about her struggle with something called poems. We've been also talking about her career as a news anchor here in Philadelphia. And she's got a new book called On Camera and Off, When the News is Good and When It's Not. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And for a time, you were able to go back on the air. You were able to be on the air, WPVI, but at some point, in fact, last year, I guess deciding,
enough. I knew after the second bone marrow transplant that I should probably call it quits with that side of my life. You know, it wasn't that I had suffered anything additional that was too hard to deal with or work with. But this wasn't something that was curable, and I was going to need a lot of time.
Yeah.
And I felt like I wasn't sure what it was yet, but I felt there would be something else I could do. I knew I would do something, and the book really wasn't part of the plan at the time. I have to thank my younger son, Leland, for that.
He said, "Mom, you should write a book."
He pushed and pushed and pushed and encouraged me, and he was right. It was very therapeutic.
You describe, and I thought it was a really interesting part of the book, about getting addicted to pain medication,
yeah,
which you were, and you describe the panic that you felt when you could not get to your drugs.
Your medication. Yeah.
And just that became the focus of your existence if you knew you could not get your drugs. At what point did you realize, I'm addicted?
Yeah, that was tough. And what the most surprising thing to me, Marty, was the doctors who were unaware that this was or could happen to me. And, you know, I had doctors that I was seeing at the time who knew everything about my illness, who were leading me on the path to recovery. I asked point blank, when this OxyContin for this nerve pain, it won't be a problem, will it? oh, no, no worries, you know, you'll be fine. Well, nerve pain first, I should say, is probably, it has to be one of the worst pains. And it got to the point where every now and then, you know, my husband being a doctor had a pill cutter. I'd cut a little extra half and I'd take it just so I wouldn't even feel the beginnings of that pain.
To ward off whatever painful
sensation. Prevent whatever was going to happen. But what was happening was I was becoming used to the regular dose and needing a little bit more and a little bit more. And he was trying to monitor. And I have to admit, I wasn't always upfront about what I was taking, sort of sneaking a little bit just to feel good, thinking like the doctors had told me, no problems. You're not going to become addicted or anything. This is fine. Well, lo and behold, we were taking my son to visit his college roommate in Rio. It was a wonderful trip he was looking forward to, but he got the time wrong. He missed the flight. And, you know, of course, I've juggled things around and called around, and we found a flight in Dulles, right outside of Washington, where he could be at Rio at the same time and not miss anything. We had to leave right from Philly International and go straight down to Dulles, two and a half hour drive. And I realized I didn't have my evening dose of OxyContin. And Bill said, I think it'll be okay. I was worried because I'd had a similar episode out late and got a little agitated before, but this time I didn't know what I was in for. You know, we were talking about 2.5 hours down, 2.5 hours back, and on the way back, I became it's so hard to describe. You just become unsettled. You're just not, you know, in your body. I became so agitated and irritated and couldn't stop moving at one point. I mean, I thought I was going to jump out of the car. I was that anxious and uneasy. And that's when I realized.
And you needed help.
I need help. I got to call Mayo and see what they have. I've got to stop taking this. I no longer knew my threshold for pain. Yeah. Even if I was having pain, I was taking this drug because I was dependent on it.
And did the therapy work?
It did. It did. I found a wonderful program at Mayo. And 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks, and it wasn't nearly as bad as I thought. I got educated, learned a lot about it from other patients there. There were 11 of us, and, of course, the wonderful doctors and therapists there.
Let me get Rob from Conshohocken to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rob. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I remember when Lisa went to London to cover the wedding of Diana and Charles. When she came home, she wrote an article in the Inquirer. In London, trucks are called lorries, and there was a truck leasing company called Thomas.
Yes.
And the signs on the road were "Lease a Thomas Lorry."
That was a signal.
That's great.
That was a signal to me, Rob, that I was in the right place at the right time.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Here's an email from Joan. She says, thank you for sharing your story. As a fellow West Virginian from Fairmount, now living in Philadelphia, you're dispelling the reinforcement of the stereotypes of our community. Do you think people have this stereotype of people growing up in West Virginia?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hillbillies, you know, mountain mama. I mean, but West Virginia is such a beautiful state. It's just, there's so many little towns and the leaves. I remember when I went to Oklahoma, I knew immediately I wasn't going to stay there. It was too flat.
Right.
You know, I had to be somewhere where they had similar mountains and beauty, and thus I'm in Pennsylvania.
You did retire in 2016. We sort of mentioned this earlier, but was that a tough decision? And is life different when you're off the air?
Oh, gosh. It bittersweet. You know, they threw me a big bash at the station, and I went on air to say goodbye to the viewers. And I knew I was going to get a little emotional, but I was a little surprised to see Jim and some of my other colleagues get a little sentimental and emotional. And they gave me a wonderful send-off, but I knew it was time. It was tough, but not quite as tough as I thought it was. I knew it was time to make a move, and I think I finally felt within that I was going to, even though I didn't know what it was then, that I was going to find another path. I didn't feel like I I wanted to travel and do some things. You know, after a bone marrow transplant, you can't travel internationally for 2 years. It wipes out everything. I had to get my polio, all my vaccines again. I'm still getting vaccines, but I knew I wanted to travel and give back. And when Leland told me, "Mom, you can help some people with the book," that began my thus began my project last summer until the book came out in early October.
Just following up on that really last question, then, what do you want this book to do?
You know, if it could just help, of course, but if it could just answer a few questions for people going through any kind of chronic illness. You know, my doctors think there are a lot more people out there who have POEMS.
Really?
Because it's so often misdiagnosed and it parallels so many other illnesses. But yeah, if I can help a handful of people navigate through this tough health system that we have, I would feel like that, you know, that my job was done well.
I'm also thinking of, again, your description of being addicted to opioids, and we think of all the people who are addicted but don't have a family and don't have a job and don't have insurance and all the things that you had to help you through it.
Exactly. And that's the reason I decided to talk about it. Initially, I wasn't. But just with my son's friends and associates, we've seen three young men in the last 5 years lose their lives over opioid addiction. And it's becoming such an epidemic, especially, you know, it's now reaching the suburbs and affluent families. And we just hope that more attention is paid to it and that something can be done about it.
Well, Lisa Thomas-Laurie, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. The book is On Camera and Off, When the News is Good and When It's Not. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be talking about Paul Manafort. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Yesterday, special counsel Robert Mueller indicted Paul Manafort, former Trump campaign manager, and his business partner, Rick Gates, who was also a senior official with the Trump campaign, on 12 counts, including money laundering, not registering as foreign agents. Shortly after President Trump tweeted, "There is no collusion," Mueller's office announced that George Papadopoulos, who was a foreign policy advisor for the Trump campaign, had pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI investigating possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. He apparently has been cooperating with the agency. Byron Tao has been following the story for the Wall Street Journal, and he joins us on Radio Times to update us on where things stand. Byron, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
So what did Mueller charge both Manafort and Gates with?
So this is a pretty serious indictment. This is a 31-page, 12-count indictment, including a number of technical banking and lobbying violations, two counts of conspiracy involving money laundering and tax charges, and a number of other very serious allegations contained in this indictment that was unsealed yesterday.
There was a lot of speculation leading up to yesterday's announcement, but the fact that the FBI had raided Manafort's apartment over the summer, did that indicate that the FBI had its eyes on him?
Definitely. And we've gotten indications that surveillance or suspicion about Manafort's business activities actually goes back long before the 2016 campaign, dating back to perhaps even 2012. Essentially, Manafort is a high-flying Washington lobbyist slash consultant who, in the last two, 3 decades, has cultivated a pretty wide international client roster, including at one point the government of Ukraine. The Ukraine at the time was ruled by a pro-Russia regime who was trying to cultivate ties in the West. And a lot of the investigations of Manafort stems from that work that started back in 2006.
Your article in today's paper, and I'm not sure we can do justice to it on the radio because it is rather complicated, but how Manafort was able to have this quote-unquote lavish lifestyle, but how he was able to move money around. This involves properties in New York and other places. It also involves some banks in Cyprus. Can you walk us through that, Byron?
Sure. So the essential scheme was that Manafort and his business partner, Rick Gates, controlled dozens of offshore entities, some of them based in Cyprus, some of them based in the UK, some of them based in the Caribbean. And he used money held by those entities or in foreign bank accounts to pay for a lot of things here in the United States. So he initiated wire transfers coming out of those companies, not coming out of his own personal bank account, to pay for example, $850,000 on men's clothing, $650,000 in landscaping. He bought 4 Range Rovers and a Mercedes-Benz. He spent nearly $1 million at an antique rug store in Alexandria, Virginia. Other wire transfers were used to pay for property. That includes a condo in Soho, the trendy Manhattan neighborhood, another $3 million brownstone house in Brooklyn. All of that was paid for out of these entities, and prosecutors allege that was used to finance a very lavish lifestyle with money he never paid U.S. taxes on.
And it, obviously, there's nothing wrong with a lavish lifestyle. The problem, at least for the government or for Mueller, is that he did not pay taxes on this.
Well, that's several of the counts involve conspiracy to commit money laundering and some banking violations. So if you control offshore accounts or you have foreign corporations, you're supposed to report that to the Treasury Department for this very reason, that they are concerned about Americans who do work abroad or do work with foreign entities trying to launder money back in through the United States. Several other counts involve the work itself. If you're a foreign lobbyist, if you work for a foreign government, you're expected to register with the Department of Justice. There are some very strict protocols you have to follow. You have to file semi-annual reports on this, and the government alleges that Manafort and Gates did not do that.
And were all these cars and apartments, was that all for Paul Manafort himself or for other people?
It's not clear. In some parts of the indictment, it does refer to his children and I believe he has some daughters and his son-in-law. And he, in other cases, the property was definitely used as either a rental property. I believe the indictment makes reference to renting it out on Airbnb, and some of the properties were mortgaged, meaning that he bought them with cash from foreign entities and then took out a mortgage on them so that he could have liquid assets that he could live off of without paying taxes on it. So it's not clear exactly who all this spending was for, but it certainly was a scheme that involves $75 million and up to $18 million transferred from foreign entities. And so this is a pretty serious indictment from the special counsel's office.
Now, was he working for the Trump campaign when he was also working as a foreign agent for Ukraine?
So, no, there was no overlap in the time he was working for the government of Ukraine and when he came on to the Trump campaign. So he stops working for the government of Ukraine in late 2014 when that regime was driven out of power, and he starts working for the Trump campaign in early to mid-2016. But prosecutors do say that a lot of the transfers did happen, or there was some overlap in the timeline, and that this continued well into 2016. So the foreign agent, the unregistered lobbying accusations happened prior to joining the Trump campaign, but the prosecutors say that a lot of these transfers seem to have continued right up through last year.
And who's this guy, Rick Gates?
Rick Gates is another longtime Republican consultant. He's been a business partner of Paul Manafort's for a while. He worked on the same account, essentially working for this government of Ukraine, and he also joined the Trump campaign around the same time. And he actually left. He actually stayed in Trump's orbit well into this year. So Manafort was forced out as campaign manager in August of 2016, in part over some investigative reporting that showed he was linked to the government of Ukraine and that he may have done some unregistered lobbying. The Trump campaign forces him out, but Rick Gates actually sticks around, becomes deputy campaign manager, and works on the presidential transition. After the transition, he goes and works for a pro-Trump outside group. So he's been in the president's orbit for a fairly long time.
That's Byron Tao, and he's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, talking about yesterday's announcement, the indictment of Paul Manafort and Rick Gates. Now, they have pleaded not guilty. They're under house arrest, and their passports were taken away. You can join join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments for our guest, Byron Tao? Now, this George Papadopoulos, was that a surprise? And that seems to be the big catch, if I can use that word, that was part of the news of yesterday.
Yeah, so that caught, I think, almost everyone by surprise, including, I think, the White House. They were prepared to argue that anything that happened involving Paul Manafort and Rick Gates happened long before the campaign, that all this unregistered lobbying and money laundering was predated his involvement with Trump World, and that he had very little to do with the White House and with Mr. Trump's governing agenda. But this fellow, George Papadopoulos, actually was indicted for lying to the FBI and actually pled guilty, I should say. And the conduct, the underlying conduct that the FBI was asking about actually happened during the campaign. So there was, they were asking him about some contacts he had with a professor who he knew to be close to the Russian government, and prosecutors say he lied about that and destroyed evidence concerning his contacts with foreign nationals. He erased his Facebook account. He got rid of his cell phone, and they say he materially misled them and offered a false statement.
Well, it sounded like he was trying to set up a meeting between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. Am I overstating that?
I mean, that is essentially what that is the picture that the indictment paints. Now, some of the names are redacted. Some of the folks involved in this are unknown. But it does seem like the Russian government, or perhaps a cutout for the Russian government, or people close to the Russian government, were trying to get an in into the campaign. And in one case, he's even said he was offered dirt on Hillary Clinton and a trove of her emails. And it does seem like he was trying to establish, or the Russian government was trying to establish, a back channel with him to the Trump campaign.
Now, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about this yesterday at the White House. She said basically he was a volunteer, almost making it sound like he might have been someone on the level of answering phones or something, that part of the campaign that was not really that important. Let me play something that goes back to 2016, and this was President Trump talking about his foreign policy team. He was talking to the Washington Post, and he was listing people that, if he were president, who might sit on his foreign policy team.
Waleed Faris, who you probably know, PhD, advisor to the House of Representatives Caucus, and he's a counterterrorism expert. Carter Page, PhD. George Papadopoulos, he's an oil and energy consultant. Excellent guy.
So there is some question, Byron, about just what his involvement was as a member of the campaign. My understanding is that he wasn't paid, nor was Paul Manafort and some others as well. The president, or the candidate Trump, talking about this person would be part of his foreign policy team. Does that in any way reveal something about his position within the campaign, him being, of course, George Papadopoulos?
Yeah, so it's not unusual for an advisor, someone advising the candidate on foreign policy, to be unpaid. Often folks who take those advisory roles are typically very senior and offer advice or counsel to the campaigns for free. In this case, President Trump was running as an outsider. He had very few foreign policy experts flocking to his campaign to advise him. He was offering a very unique and unorthodox foreign policy. And so it seems that this young man, he was, I think, in his late 20s or early 30s at the time, was acting essentially as a foreign policy advisor to the campaign. He had a background as an energy consultant. He had worked for think tanks before, but he wasn't someone that was well known. It doesn't sound like, from the reporting, that he was the kind of person just getting coffee and answering the phones. But we don't know. There's a famous Instagram now of him sitting at the table with the president and some other national security types, and you know, it raises questions about how high up he was and how much access he had to the future president.
Let me get Evan from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Evan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning,
morning
to you both. I have a quick question, and it's regarding Manafort and the possibility of a presidential pardon. If a president pardons somebody, they're no longer liable under federal charges, but that does not include state charges. So my question to Byron is, in his research, how much of Manafort's alleged money laundering has flowed through New York, i.e. Trump Tower, which would make him possibly still liable in the event of a pardon?
Can you answer that, Byron?
Well, that's a good question. I'd have to go back to the indictment to see which states the money was spent in, but it's certainly a possibility that he could be brought up on state-level charges. And I think we do know that the Attorney General of New York has said he is interested in investigating some of the questions around the President and the Russia investigation. So it is entirely possible that even if he's offered a blanket pardon at the federal level, that he could still face some state-level troubles.
You mentioned the fact that Papadopoulos said that he could, he was talking to someone who had dirt on Hillary Clinton. This, of course, raises the question about the meeting that Donald Trump Jr. had with a Russian lawyer claiming to have dirt on Hillary Clinton, ended up being about the Magnitsky Act. But is there a connection, you think, between these two, what are they, dangles? I'm not even sure what they are.
Yeah, well, they both seem to relate to something that was a bit of an obsession for, I guess, both the campaign and the media at the time. There was a lot of reporting about Hillary Clinton and her emails and the deleted emails, and both the meeting in Trump Tower and this George Papadopoulos's contacts with folks that appear to be close to the Kremlin relate to getting those documents. And I think prosecutors will be probing the relation and sort of how deeply involved the Russian state or agents of the Russian state or cutouts for the Russian state were in both of these incidents.
Do we know how the White House is responding to what Mueller said and did yesterday?
Well, they're certainly trying to distance themselves from a lot of this. You know, the White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said that this has nothing to do with us. She described Manafort's conduct as predating his involvement with the Trump campaign. This morning on Twitter, the president called Papadopoulos a liar, a known liar, and distancing himself from this young this fellow. So there's certainly an attempt to insulate the president and say that these were low-level things, or these were people that were these were things that predated his presidential run.
And do we know, or do you know, what Mueller is looking into now?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. The fact that Papadopoulos was arrested in late July, and this did not leak, Washington is a famously gossipy town, seems to indicate to me that Mueller is running a pretty tight ship. You know, we do know he's looking at the National Security Advisor, Mike Flynn, who was forced to resign in February, and we do know he's probing questions of obstruction of justice around James Comey's firing. But I would not be surprised if there were other completely unexpected developments that have not been speculated on or reported that come down the pike.
Byron, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Byron Tao, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.